This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
the mood was electric when Robert Mugabe showed up to vote this afternoon at his traditional polling station in Harare. The crowd welcomed him, crying out his name, but also crying out the name of the opposition challenger, Nelson Chamisa.
That's VOA's Anita Powell reporting from Harare. We'll have the latest on the Zimbabwe elections next.
Also, Malians went to the polls yesterday in what's widely expected to be the first round of Mali's presidential elections. And Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed is wrapping up his first visit to the Ethiopian community in the U.S. with a two-day stop in Minnesota.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, Zimbabweans are voting today in a pivotal election that could, many hope, turn around the nation's shattered economy and tarnished reputation after 38 years of iron-fisted rule under former leader Robert Mugabe. The two main presidential rivals voted this morning and each said they were confident of victory. This poll is effectively a two-way race between President Emmerson Mnangagwa, who took over after Mugabe's resignation in November, and opposition leader Nelson Chamisa. Yesterday, Mugabe lashed out at the political party he founded, ZANU-PF, accusing it of deposing him in a coup. While he did not name his choice, he hinted heavily he would vote for Chamisa. Today, a frail Mugabe, assisted by his wife Grace and daughter Bona, arrived to a welcoming crowd at his polling station in the middle-class Highfield suburb. Our colleague Anita Powell was there when Mugabe cast his vote. She spoke with me about the atmosphere on the ground and what the expectations are in this historic election.
The mood was electric when Robert Mugabe showed up to vote this afternoon at his traditional polling station in Harare. The crowd welcomed him, crying out his name, but also crying out the name of the opposition challenger, Nelson Chamisa. The way that they speak about him is they call him Chiza, Chiza, Chiza. They yelled out Chiza and also Mugabe's nickname. So he got an ecstatic reception. He went in to vote. He took an awful long time to vote. In his little cardboard box, he was assisted by his daughter, Bona, and his wife, Grace. Did not speak to the media on his way out. It was quite an event, and the people there were very happy to see him.
Yesterday, he said that he would not give ZANU-PF his support. So as I guess you just mentioned, he didn't give any indication of who he would be voting for.
I asked him directly, Mr. Mugabe, who did you vote for? Who are you going to vote for? And he did not answer my question. But yes, as you say, yesterday he indicated that he would not vote for the ZANU-PF ruling party and indicated that he might likely vote for opposition leader Nelson Chamisa.
And how does Nelson Chamisa feel about this election?
Nelson Chamisa, I saw earlier today at his polling station in Harare, and he feels confident. He says this is more or less a done deal. Victory is assured for the opposition. He feels clearly very confident. When asked by another journalist about President Mnangagwa's angry response to Mugabe's quasi-endorsement, he said, "I don't want to talk about that." So he is maybe distancing himself a little bit from Mugabe, but he seems confident to victory.
What about the other challengers? How are they feeling about this election?
Well, Emmerson Mnangagwa, the current president, voted out of town about 3 hours out of Harare along with his wife this morning, and he seemed calm and confident. Again, all of the presidential challengers seem pretty pumped up and assured of victory, or at least they believe in themselves and their ability to win. The two main rivals both believe that they've got this in the bag.
Overall, how is voting going, and are there any issues at this point?
So it's a little early in the day. We're right around midday right now. So far, we haven't heard of any major issues, especially not in Harare, which, of course, being the capital, is very well watched and very saturated with media. That's an important consideration. But so far, we haven't heard of any major problems with the vote. A lot of the concerns really centered more on the run-up to the poll, the voters' roll, the ink, which we're now seeing some social media posts saying that the ink can be very easily removed. I'm speaking of the ink that you put on your finger after you vote to make sure you don't vote again. There are little things like that. But so far, we haven't heard anything, definitely not in the capital, of any major problems. There are little bits and bobs from the outer parts of the country, but those are very hard to verify. We're not there. And so I believe we're going to have to wait a little bit before we really have a clear picture.
And what are Zimbabweans saying they want out of this election?
So every Zimbabwean I've spoken says at the end of the day, they want jobs. They want the economy to improve. The second most quoted thing is they want change, which indicates that they are not inclined to vote for ZANU-PF, the ruling party, which has been in power for more than 38 years.
That was Anita Powell speaking with me from Harare.
And as reported in Zimbabwe, voters have turned out in large numbers for the first post-Mugabe election to vote to fill the presidency and other public offices for the next 5 years. While lacking the violence of past elections, reports emerged that the balloting has not been completely smooth. Reporter Kuzai Zanwashi has an update on the proceedings.
Tendai Zhou is a young Zimbabwean. On the eve of today's polls, she spoke about her hopes.
I hope for change, and I also hope that the process will be smooth for us. I just hope the people who will be facilitating the whole process will make it snappy so that we won't have to stand in queues for such a long time.
Munyaradzi Dodo is the editor of Open Pali, an online publication that has been covering elections through a network of citizen journalists.
So far, it's been largely peaceful. No incidences of violence, but there has been concerning incidences. ERC reported that there's a missing polling station in Glenview, which is not where it's supposed to be, so which is a cause for concern because Glenview is a high-density area.
Dodo says there are other concerning issues.
There's been reports of intimidation in rural areas, of village heads acting as party agents. So this might deter people from voting in a direction that they might have wanted to. There's reports of some polling stations and opening late. The queues are very long. There's a high voter turnout.
With some businesses open, human rights lawyer and activist Doug Coulthard has been busy trying to ensure all workers get to vote.
I've been calling a lot of private companies that have been denying their employees opportunity to go and vote, calling them, explaining to them the law that it's actually a criminal offence to do that.
While Coulthard says companies have been receptive, activists like him await the end of the day to know how many employees were allowed to go and vote. He says they will certainly follow up with legal action in cases where companies did not heed their calls. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
Officials in Mali are counting the votes from yesterday's presidential election. President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita is seeking a second term against 23 other candidates. If no one wins more than 50% of the vote, a runoff is scheduled for August 12th. Amid fears of violence, light turnout was reported. Only about half the voters in two regions received voter cards, so more than 800,000 people may have been unable to cast ballots. Voting was briefly suspended in a northern village after militants fired rockets at a nearby United Nations camp. No one was injured. In several other villages, election officials were beaten up, ballot boxes burned, and armed groups stopped election supervisors from entering polling stations. Some candidates and European election monitors also reported fake voting stations were set up in several spots. A credible outcome would help solidify a peace agreement between the government, pro-government forces, and former Tuareg rebels in combating Islamic extremists in the largely lawless north.
A controversial referendum today in the Comoros could scrap the tiny country's power rotation system and end the single-term limit for the presidency. Opponents claim the referendum is illegal and designed to allow President Azali Assoumani to seek two more five-year terms instead of stepping down when his current mandate ends in 2021. Currently, the three main islands of the Comoros, located between Mozambique and Madagascar and home to about 800,000 people, are supposed to rotate power every 5 years. But Assoumani says that limits stability, and he also wants the authority to drop the three vice presidencies. One of the vice presidents survived an assassination attempt a week ago. The country has suffered more than 20 coups or coup attempts since independence from France in 1975. The referendum also would drop secularism and make Islam the state religion. The country is 99% Sunni Muslim.
New data released at the 2018 AIDS conference in Amsterdam warns that if donor government funding for HIV continues to fall, nearly two decades of progress against the disease will be in jeopardy. Using newly available data, a study from researchers at the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation and the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health showed that cuts to development assistance for HIV could do serious harm. Linda Gail Becker is president of the International AIDS Society and professor of medicine and deputy director of the Desmond Tutu HIV Center at the Institute of Infectious Disease and Molecular Medicine at the University of Cape Town. She spoke with me from the conference and said now is not the time for donors to pull back.
Global investments have been very important in the fight against AIDS so far, and I think we really are beginning to see some impact of that. But we are quite concerned because data would show that global donors are cutting and restricting funds, and that obviously puts that all that investment and all the progress we've made to date in great danger. And that is one of the points we're really hoping to highlight here at Amsterdam 2018.
Why is it that funding is starting to fall off?
You know, I think there are probably multiple reasons for that. One is, you know, I think we have been quite vocal about the success we've had to date, and some of that has been translated into what I would call premature triumphalism. You know, I think sort of announcing the end of AIDS, et cetera, over the last few years, I think has been a strategic mistake because I think we aren't at the end of AIDS. And in fact, the data being shown at this conference would suggest that we're off track to meet the goals that we had set for ourselves. So whilst there's been great progress, we actually need to increase our effort at the moment. And that's going to take resources rather than people saying, gosh, it looks like the problem is solved and disengaging, which is the worst thing that could happen.
And given this, how are developing countries doing in terms of AIDS prevention and research and treatment?
There are a few things. The one is that developing countries definitely are stepping up more than ever before. So the one area where we did see an increase in funding over the last year was in-country funding. So local funding definitely has increased. The true reality, though, is in the poorest developing countries, which is often where the greatest burden is, those countries remain very dependent on donor funding, not only for prevention, but also for their treatment needs. And the truth of the matter is that when funding starts to regress, the first thing that goes is actually prevention, simply because it's very difficult to stop treating somebody with, you know, a lifelong treatment. So governments will clearly, and health systems will do their best to keep those who need treatment going, but all our prevention efforts fall away. And so the immediate thing that happens is we lose pace on providing prevention opportunities.
How is the conference helping to shed light on this need to continue to fund for AIDS research?
Well, I think we are definitely showing the data. It's very important to see that in 50 countries, we've actually seen an increase in HIV rates. So that is the first very disturbing concept. But at the same time, we also want to have a very balanced view to show that we're making some huge progress in other regions of the world where we're starting to see a downturn in incidence. You know, I think we've got some really good news stories coming out of Eastern and Southern Africa where a few years ago the picture was very dismal indeed. So it's about getting a balanced picture out of, on the one hand, the investment is paying off and we're starting to see success. So it's not hopeless. It's not doom and gloom. On the other hand, there's still much work to be done, particularly in key populations and in certain regions of the world. And if we don't push through, then we may see a reignition of the epidemic and we may find ourselves pretty much back where we were when we started or close to. You know, I've said it before, I'll say it again, if we are not moving forward with this epidemic, then we're sliding back simply because we have infections happening and we have a treatment pool that continues to increase on a daily basis.
Linda Gail Becker is president of the International AIDS Society. She spoke with me from the AIDS Conference in Amsterdam.
Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed is wrapping up his first visit to the Ethiopian community in the United States with a two-day stop in Minnesota. It is the second largest group of African immigrants in America, trailing only Nigerians, and includes talented doctors, bankers, academics, and engineers. They gave him a warm welcome in three major U.S. cities. In his first 100 days in office, the new prime minister has introduced major political, economic, and diplomatic initiatives. Dr. Peter Pham, vice president of the Atlantic Council and director of its Africa Center, explained to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi the significance of the visit and the prime minister's reforms.
I think the diaspora, in many respects, not just for Ethiopia, but really almost every African country, represent an enormous pool of human capital, people who are talented, ambitious, energetic, and in some cases also because of the success they've had, also with the means to help development even financially in their home country. So I think it's an important outreach. In the case of the Ethiopian diaspora, many of which have been in the past alienated from the government in their home country, the fact that he's receiving such a rapturous welcome from them, I think, is particularly significant. Many of these people had backed the opposition over the years, and that they're welcoming him and rallying behind him is extraordinary. I had the opportunity to be with Prime Minister Abe when he met with some of the leaders of the diaspora, and the enthusiasm that they showed for him was really stunning and heartwarming.
In his first 100 days in office, Ethiopian Prime Minister has closed prisons, released political prisoners, and opened up the political space. How would such reforms impact stability and development in Ethiopia?
Well, I think almost everything he's done, I think, contributes to the long-term development and sustainable stability of the country over the long term. In the short term, obviously, when you have such a frenetic pace of change, so many momentous reforms, that's going to unsettle things. So there's inevitably a bit of turbulence, some of it from resistance, some of it from energies long pent up. So I think the important thing, I think, to remember, and this is both for the international community and for Ethiopians, is to manage expectations. He's bringing a lot of change. He's clearly brought a new climate within the country and into the region, but the man is also only human, and one can only do so much, and one is constrained also by basic laws of economics and geopolitics, so the expectations need to be managed.
Mr. Ahmed led a historic deal to end two decades of Cold War with Eritrea, improved relations with Sudan, and has been trying to ease tensions with Egypt over the Renaissance Dam. What's your take on that?
I think all are important. Ethiopia is a regional power in East Africa. More than 90 million people, the huge potential to solve much of the region's energy deficit through its building of the dam, but it needs to be done in a way that doesn't also negatively impact other countries, including Egypt. And the fact that he's engaging with these countries is good for the security and stability of the region, but it's also good for Ethiopia, not only politically, but economically. Certainly better relations with Eritrea will increase not only commerce, but give Ethiopia alternative access to the sea, which will also help the Ethiopian economy.
That was Dr. Peter Pham, Vice President of the Atlantic Council and Director of its Africa Center. He spoke to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
The government of South Africa says the country could lose tens of millions of dollars in steel and aluminum exports per year and thousands of jobs because of import tariff hikes recently imposed on it by the United States. South Africa, Africa's second strongest economy, describes the duties as unfair because it isn't in any way responsible for the global steel glut. The U.S. Commerce Department has said imports of steel and other products are a threat to America's national security as they weaken the country's economy. Some economists see the stance as part of a trade war between the U.S. and China. Darren Taylor reports.
An economic diplomacy expert at South Africa's Institute of International Affairs, Chelsea Markowitz, says the ramifications of a possible trade war between the world's most powerful economies have been exaggerated. She maintains it's not in America's or China's best interests to maintain a long trade dispute. So at this stage, she says, South African exporters to the US appear overly concerned.
Any sort of protectionism globally is not good. But I don't think there'll be major impacts in the long term. And South Africa's exposure to the US is quite small in these industries compared to other countries.
South Africa's Trade and Industry Department says the country accounts for slightly more than 1.5% of US aluminum imports and less than 1% of annual steel imports. But they're worth about $1.4 billion. Senior economist at Stellenbosch University's Bureau for Economic Research, Hugo Pinar, says local steel industry groups have a right to be anxious.
According to them, the 25% tariff on steel will cost South African steel importers about 3 billion rand worth of income. On the aluminium side, they estimate that is about 500 million rand losses that could result in. And then, of course, the impact of that may be that there are job losses in the sector.
The government says 7,500 jobs are at stake. Pinar says if global growth slows because of a trade war between the US and China, commodity prices will plummet.
This is, of course, South Africa's key exports, things like platinum, iron ore, coal. Those prices may be negatively impacted by the trade war.
South Africa is also worried that China will divert its aluminum exports to Europe and Asia, cutting into South Africa's positions in its biggest markets. Pinar says South Africa will suffer another blow if President Donald Trump raises duties on vehicles. The country exported almost 40,000 vehicles to the US last year. An analyst at the Political Economy Southern Africa Research Institute, Onesisa Mtwa, says higher vehicle tariffs would mean thousands more jobs lost. Mtwa says South Africa's other manufacturers are set to suffer as they export products like home appliances.
If he were to follow through on that, that could have quite a detrimental impact on South Africa's automotive industry, because although our steel imports and aluminium imports to the US are quite small, we do export a fair amount of fully assembled vehicles to the US.
The problem for South Africa, says Mtwa, is that some of its competitors, like Australia and Brazil, are exempt from Washington's higher duties. She says the US is clearly prioritizing good relations with its larger importers and isn't concerned about smaller trade partners such as South Africa.
If there's increased tariffs on products that come from South Africa, this means there'll be less demand for them, particularly in the American market, which is a significant chunk of South Africa's export market. It's about 7% of our total export of merchandise, manufactured goods.
Mtwa says the friendliness between Pretoria and Beijing could explain why the US refused to exempt South Africa from the increased tariffs. She points out that 10% of South Africa's goods go to China, while 20% of its imports are from the Far Eastern giant.
This war with China were essentially collateral damage, and because we're so insignificant to them, they really are not obliged to give us an exemption.
Many economic analysts agree that South Africa has little choice other than to navigate the rough waters caused by the US tariff hikes and to hope that they're temporary. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for choosing the VOA.
VOAAfrica.com.
On VOAAfrica.com, the news updates never stop. Our primary goal is to keep you informed.
VOAAfrica.com, your trusted source for news and information.